The lieutenant ordered us over to the vats, which were standing under the eaves of one of the huts. We looked enviously across at the fellows who were going to get into hot showers. At least 300 men were waiting for an experience which seemed like a blessing from heaven, so close to the front. Those at the front of the line had more or less undressed, and were scratching the lice which had settled in a ring at the belt line, when we were suddenly ordered to prepare for immediate departure. For me, at least, this was a reprieve. Stripping in that icy air had begun to seem impossibly difficult. I much preferred to keep my lice relatively warm between my grey undervest and my stomach, which was rumbling with hunger. I was certainly ill again, I no longer had any doubts. I couldn't stop shivering, and felt cold right down to the soles of my feet. We piled into the open trucks, overloading them as usual. But no one complained. No matter how squashed we were, it was better than walking. However, I was soon caught in a grotesque predicament. The trucks rolled off down a road which the rains had transformed into a swamp. The truck behind us gave off two sprays of liquid mud as steady and uniform as the sprays of a municipal fountain. I was strangely reminded of the retreat from the Don. Was Russia nothing but a vast sea of mud? As always, we were driving toward a northern horizon marked by dark forests. The echoes of occasional explosions drifted to us on the wind, but they didn't sound serious. The sky was overcast and threatened rain. Huddled between two companions, I swayed to the slow rhythm of the trucks struggling through the mire. I felt more and more uncomfortable and ill. My lips and face seemed to be burning, and the slightest motion of the air felt like ice against my skin. My stomach was griped by a brutal pain, which traveled outward through my body, in waves of violent shivers. At first I thought this must be an after-effect of the hard times we'd been through, especially as I had never entirely recovered from my illness at Konotop. I knew that I must look more cadaverous than ever. My intestines were twisting themselves in knots. Naturally, no one gave a damn, and besides I was certainly not the only one with a pain in my gut. Then my pain became so imperative that I tried to double over, despite the crowding and all my gear. The fellow beside me noticed my restlessness, and leaned his hairy face toward me, "Take it easy, friend. We'll soon be there." But he clearly had no more idea where we were going than I did. I've got a hell of a pain in the gut. And this is a hell of a time to crap. Suddenly, I realized what was the matter with me. My stomach was churning with increasing violence and threatened to explode. I certainly couldn't stop a military convoy because my guts were about to turn inside out. I had to laugh at my predicament despite my shivers and cramps and salivating mouth. But I also had to try to think of a solution. The convoy was now in the middle of a forest, where there was no reason to stop. And, even if we came to a camp, I couldn't just leave my group the moment we arrived, without any apparent motive. If I did that, they might even shoot me as a deserter. But could I hold out much longer? I tried desperately to think of something else, but failed. My pains increased, and I broke out in goose flesh. Finally, my gut simply opened. "Move over a little, fellow," I said, grimacing. "I've got terrible diarrhea, and I can't wait anymore." The truck was making a lot of noise, and no one seemed to hear me. I shoved with my elbows, and shouted louder. The fellows on either side of me moved back about 4 inches, but paid no further attention. I could feel myself blushing with embarrassment. I tried to undo my clothes, jostling one of my neighbors. "What's the hurry?" he said. "You'll be able to crap when we get there." "But I'm sick, damn it." He muttered something and moved one of his feet, although there was really nowhere to put it. No one laughed, in fact, everybody seemed entirely indifferent to my plight. I struggled desperately with my clothes, but in the cramped space, encumbered with all my equipment, I was unable to free the lower half of my body. Finally, I realized there was nothing I could do. My bowels emptied, pouring a stream of vile liquid down my legs. No one seemed even to notice my condition, which left me in a state of indescribable misery. My stomach was knotted with pain, and I collapsed into a stupefied torpor which prevented me from appreciating the ridiculous aspects of my situation. In fact, the situation was not particularly funny. I was really seriously ill, and my head was spinning and burning with fever. This was the first attack of a chronic dysentery which has plagued me ever since. Our journey continued for a considerable time, during which I suffered two further attacks of uncontrollable diarrhea. Although my state of filth was scarcely aggravated by these eruptions, I would gladly have exchanged 10 years of my life for a chance to clean off and fall asleep in a warm bed. I was shaken by alternate fits of shivers and burning heat, and the pain in my intestines grew more and more intense. After what seemed like an eternity, we arrived at our new camp, and I was dragged from the truck for roll call. My head was swimming, but, although fainting would have guaranteed the quickest route to the infirmary, I struggled to remain conscious. Somehow, I managed to stay upright among my comrades, each preoccupied with his own fate. However, my ghastly appearance did not escape the attention of the inspecting officer, and my gasping replies to his questions interrupted the regular rhythm of roll call. "What's the matter with you?" he asked. "I'm sick. I was barely able to stammer a reply, and saw him only as a blurred and shifting silhouette. "What's bothering you?" "My stomach. I have a fever. Could I please go and wash, hair? Take him to the medical service as an urgent case," continued the officer, speaking to a subordinate. The latter stepped forward and took me by the arm. Someone was actually trying to help me. I could hardly believe it. "I've got acute diarrhea, and I have to clean off," I groaned as we tottered off. "You'll find everything you need in the sanitary block, camarade." At the infirmary, I stood in line behind some 30 other men. The pains in my abdomen tore at my entrails with an intensity which made me scream. I knew that my gut was about to pour out some more filth. I staggered from the line, trying to make my step firm, and followed the signs to the latrine. When that series of intestinal explosions was finished, I hesitated before pulling up my revolting trousers. Although I was in an incredible state of filth, I noticed that my excrement was streaked with blood. I went back to the infirmary to stand in line for another half hour. Then my turn came. One after the other, I peeled off my nauseating rags. "My God, what a stink!" exclaimed one of the orderlies, whose outlook was probably identical with that of the motto over the gate of our training camp, "Ein Laus, der Tod." I looked at the long table where members of the sanitary service were sitting like judges. The only plea I could possibly make was guilty. "Dysenteric diarrhea," muttered one of the judges, obviously shocked by the shit which ran down below my knees. "Get to the showers, you pig," the other said. "We'll look at you when you're clean. There's nothing I'd like better. You don't know how long I've been dreaming of a shower." "Right over that way," said the first fellow, who was clearly anxious to be rid of me. I threw my coat over my bony shoulders, and went across to the showers. Luckily, no one was there but a bewildered-looking boy who was scrubbing the floor. "Any hot water in the showers?" "Do you want hot water?" His voice was gentle and friendly. "Do you have any?" "Yes. 2 big vats for 16th Company Laundry. I could let you have some, though. The showers only run cold." Through my fever, I saw him as another bastard who'd do a favor for cigarettes or something else. "I don't have any cigarettes." "That doesn't matter. I don't smoke." I stood where I was, considerably surprised. "Well, then, could you do it right away?" But the fellow was already hurrying off. "Go in there," he said, pointing over his shoulder to an open cubicle. "You'll be more comfortable." 2 minutes later he was back, carrying 2 buckets of steaming water. "Were you at the front?" he asked. I looked at him, wondering what he was trying to find out. He was still smiling his foolish smile. "Yes. And I've had enough of it, too, if you want to know. I'm sick and disgusted. It must be terrible. Feldwilhelf says that pretty soon now he'll be sending me off to get killed. I went on with the extraordinary relief of washing off my backside, but looked up at him with some surprise. There are always fellows like that, who enjoy sending other fellows out to get it in the neck. What do you do? I was called up 3 months ago. I left Herrfechter, and after basic training in Poland was enrolled in the Gross Deutschland. That's a familiar story, I thought to myself. Who's Herrfechter? My boss. A little strict, but nice anyway. I've worked for him since I was a kid. Your parents sent you out so young. I don't have any parents. Herrfechter took me straight from the orphanage. There's a lot of work on his farm. I stared at him, someone else whose luck had been a little thin. He was still smiling. I clutched my stomach, which once again felt as if it might explode. What's your name?
Frosch.
Helmut Frosch. Thank you, Frosch. Now I must try to get into the infirmary. I was preparing to leave when I noticed a short, thick-set figure standing in the doorway watching us. Before I could say a word, the man shouted, "Frosch!" Frosch spun around, and ran back to the wet rag he'd left on the floor. I went out slowly, trying to pass by unnoticed. But the Feldwell in any case was concentrating on Frosch.
"Frosch!
You left your work. Why?" "I was only asking him about the war, Sergeant. You were forbidden to talk during punishment fatigue, Frosch, except to answer my questions." Frosch was about to reply when a sonorous whack cut him short. I looked back. The Feld's hand, which had just given it to Frosch full in the face, was still raised. I took myself off as fast as I could, as a torrent of abuse poured over my unfortunate companion. "Bastard!" I shouted silently at the Feld. At the sanitary service, the aide looked at me without enthusiasm. I understood immediately that he was one of these fastidious fellows for whom a day of filthy scarecrows like myself was less than a pleasure, especially as he received no fees to encourage civility. He fingered all my parts, poking me a little all over, and concluded his examination by sticking his finger into my mouth to check the condition of my teeth. Then he added a string of numbers and letters to a card clipped to my papers, and I was sent down the line of tables to the surgical service. 5 or 6 fellows that checked my documents and asked me to remove some of the clothes I'd thrown over my shoulders. A brute who must have been a wild man of the woods in civilian life gave me a shot in the left pectoral muscle, and I was taken to the hospital hut, where there were beds for the officially disabled. My papers were checked once again, and then, like a miracle, I was shown to a bed which in fact was only a simple pallet covered with grey cloth. There were no sheets or blankets, but it was nonetheless a genuine bed on a wooden frame, in a dry room protected by a roof. I collapsed onto the bed, to relish its comforts. My head was ringing with fever, and filled with a host of half-realized impressions. I had grown so used to sleeping on the ground that the degree of well-being a soft, clean mattress can induce struck me with astonishment. The room was full of cots like mine on which fellows were lying, whimpering and groaning. But I paid no more attention to them than one does to a hotel carpet which is not entirely to one's liking. I felt almost light-headed with well-being, despite the pain which tore at my entrails. I took off some of my clothes and spread my filthy coat and ground sheet over my body instead of blankets, burying myself in them and in the sense that I had been saved. I lay like that for a long time, trying to control the cramps which knotted my guts. After a while, 2 orderlies arrived, carrying a cumbersome piece of equipment. Without a word of warning, they pulled off my covers. "Turn over, Kamerad, and let us have a look at your ass. We want to clean out your gut." Before I understood what was happening, they had administered a copious enema, and moved on to the next patient, leaving me with some 5 quarts of medicated liquid gurgling painfully in my distended abdomen. I don't know anything about medicine, but an enema has always struck me as a strange treatment for someone who is suffering from excessively frequent evacuations. The fact is that 2 repetitions of this operation enormously increased the misery of the next day and night, which I spent tottering to and from the latrine. This was situated some distance from the infirmary, which meant fighting the strong, icy wind which blew continuously. Any benefits I might have received from this amount of time ostensibly resting in bed were thus reduced to almost nothing. 2 days later, I was pronounced cured, and sent back to my company on rubble legs. My company, the one which had been organized as an assault group, was stationed in the immediate vicinity, only 5 or 6 miles from divisional headquarters, in a tiny hamlet which had been half abandoned by the Russian civilian population. Despite my intense joy at reuniting with my friends, all of whom were present, including Olsheim, my condition remained as precarious as it had been the day before I went to the infirmary. My close friends, Hals, Lenson, and the veteran, made a special effort over me, and did everything they could to help me get well. Above all, they insisted on pouring large quantities of vodka down my throat, which, according to them, was the only reliable remedy for my complaint. However, my precipitate visits to the latrine continued despite these excellent attentions, and the sight of my bloody excrement worried even the veteran, who went with me on these trips in case I fainted. Twice, on the urging of my friends, I tried to re-enter the hospital, which was inundated with wounded from the Battle of Kiev, but my papers, stating that I had been cured, presented an insuperable barrier. I began to look like a tragic protagonist, made of some curious, white diaphanous substance, instead of flesh and blood. I no longer left the pallet which had been given to me in one of the izbas. Fortunately, a reduced service requirement allowed me to stay where I was. Several times, my friends took guard duty for me and did the other jobs which would ordinarily have been required of me. Everything was going well in the company, which was still commanded by Wezridow. Unfortunately, we were still in a combat zone, which meant that at any minute we might be sent to some exposed position. Wezridow knew that I would not be able to function in combat conditions as well as I knew it myself. One evening, about a week after I'd left the infirmary, I became delirious, and was completely unaware of a fierce aerial battle which took place directly overhead. From some points of view, you're really the lucky one, Hals joked. Hals even went to speak to Wezridow about me. But, before he was able to explain himself, Wezridow stood up and smiled. My boy, we'll be pulling out almost immediately. They're sending us to an occupied zone at least 60 miles farther west. We'll have a certain amount to do the, but even so it will seem like a holiday after this. Tell your sick friend to hang on for another 24 hours and spread the news that we're moving. We'll all be no better off. Hals clicked his heels hard enough to shatter his shins, and burst out of Wezridow's quarters like a hurricane. He looked into every but he passed, shouting out the good news. When he reached us, he shook me from my torpor. You're saved, Sager. You're saved. He shouted. We'll be leaving soon for a real rest. He turned to a couple of fellows who shared the hut with us. We've got to get all the quinine we can for him. He has to hang on another 24 hours. Despite my overwhelming weakness, Hals's intense joy communicated itself to me, and ran through me like a restorative balm. You're saved. He said again. And just think, with a fever like yours, they're bound to take you in a hospital and they won't cut it off your leave either. You are a lucky dog. Every time I moved I felt it in my stomach, which seemed to be rapidly liquefying. Nonetheless, I began to collect my things. Everyone around me was doing the same. I put my packet of letters within easy reach. A voluminous backlog of correspondence had been kept for me by the Divisional Postal Service. There were at least a dozen letters from Paula, which greatly eased my illness, as well as 3 from my parents, full of questions, anxiety, and reproaches about my long silence. There was even one from Frau Neubuck. Somehow I found the strength to write everyone, although my fever undoubtedly interfered with the coherence of my messages. Finally, we left. I was given a place in a small auto union truck, and we drove to Vinnytsia on roads which belonged to the Carolingian era. Our faltering machines almost drowned in incredible quagmires, whose condition was aggravated by the rain. For a while I thought we had reached the notorious Pripyat marshes, which were in fact not very far away. We avoided them by driving around them, on extraordinary wooden pavements which seemed to be floating on mud. These uneven roads made of split logs, on which one could obviously not drive very fast, were surprisingly effective in wet weather. However, it took us at least 8 hours to travel 90 miles. The weather was cold and bad snow flurries alternating with violent bursts of rain, but at least this protected us from Soviet aircraft, which were very active at that time. When we arrived, I was sent immediately to a hospital, along with some 6 others from my company. Diarrhea was a common complaint at that time, and a group of specialists were able to stop mine very quickly. My friends were stationed some 15 miles away, and I knew I would rejoin them once I was well. The doctors had some trouble getting me on my feet again. I was told that because my complaint had not been attacked until late in the day, my intestinal flora had been severely damaged. In fact, it was a good 2 weeks before I was able to eat normally again. Every day I offered my backside to the orderly, who stabbed me as full of holes as a dressmaker's pincushion. Twice a day, the thermometer recorded my fever, which remained obstinately at 108 degrees. Winter had arrived, and I rejoiced as I watched the snow falling from behind the panes of a heated dormitory. I knew that for the moment my friends were out of danger, and, in a state of blissful ignorance, was unaware that over the whole front things were going from bad to worse. Our paper's coverage of news from the front was limited to photographs of smiling artillerymen installing themselves in a new position, or organizing their winter quarters, and articles which said nothing at all. Hals came to see me twice, bringing mail. He had managed to get himself made a postal assistant, which allowed him to visit me quite easily. He rejoiced at the slightest occasion for rejoicing, roaring with laughter whenever he missed me in a snowball fight. He was just as ignorant as I of the realities of our situation, which would soon involve us in an agonizing retreat, and acquaint us with the depths of horror. When I had been in the hospital for about 3 weeks, I was given some marvelous news. I was told to go to the office to be checked for discharge. There an orderly inspected me, and told me that, since I was making a good recovery, he was going to authorize a leave for me. "It occurs to me," he said, "that you would rather complete your convalescence at home than here in the hospital." I replied that I would, restricting myself to mild assent, lest I offend that kindly angel with excessive exuberance. As a result, I found myself with a 10-day pass a little shorter than the first one, which would go into effect as soon as it had been stamped. I thought immediately of Berlin and Paula. I would try to get permission for her to go with me to France. And, if that was impossible, I would stay in Berlin with her. Despite the weakness, which still limited me severely, I was overjoyed. I got ready in record time, and left the hospital grinning broadly. I also wrote a note to my friends, excusing myself for not having visited them before I left. I thought they would surely understand. My polished boots moved noiselessly across the snow as I walked to the station. I was so overflowing with happiness that I even nodded and spoke to the Russians I passed on the way. My linen and uniform had been cleaned and mended, and I myself felt neat and new. I forgot my bygone sufferings, and felt only gratitude to the German army and to the Führer for having made me into a man who knew the value of clean sheets and a watertight roof, and of friends who had nothing to offer but devotion, and offered that without reserve. I felt happy once again, and ashamed to have been despairing and afraid. I thought back, from a great distance, to some of the hard times I had experienced during my youth in France, which had sometimes made me think sourly of life. But was there anything that could sour me now? What disappointment could possibly darken things for me? Perhaps if Paula suddenly told me she no longer cared for me. Dot. Yes, perhaps that. But I felt as though I were now cured of a great many things. During some of my worst moments, I had imagined certain personal disasters, the death of my mother, for instance, and told myself that I could accept even that, if only the firing would stop. I had asked the pardon of every supernatural power for harboring such thoughts, but was prepared to pay that price if it would cut short the carnage by even a little. The war seemed to have turned me into a monster of indifference, a man without feelings. I was still 3 months short of 18, but felt at least 35. Now that I have reached that age, I know better. Peace has brought me many pleasures, but nothing as powerful as that passion for survival in wartime, that faith in love, and that sense of absolutes. It often strikes me with horror that peace is really extremely monotonous. During the terrible moments of war, one longs for peace with a passion that is painful to bear. But in peacetime one should never, even for an instant, long for war. The station was at the end of a cul-de-sac. In front of the esplanade, which took the place of a platform, three wide-gauge Russian tracks ran for a short distance, and then were regrouped into two switchings. A third section of the track vanished after 500 yards, without any apparent reason. The soft snow deadened all noise and made everything still uncovered look cold and black. A few wagons and a few empty boxes lay scattered across this peculiarly empty place. Beside the principal station building stood a neat pile of boxes marked WH. Inside, next to a hot stove, four or five Russian railway men sat absolutely motionless, as if they had died of boredom. There was no sign of a train in any direction, except for a large stationary locomotive, which appeared to be near death after a century of hard use. I no longer remember the name of the place. Perhaps it didn't have one, or perhaps the signboard had been stuck off in some odd corner so that we Europeans shouldn't catch sight of its unreadable characters. The prospect of a train passing through seemed as remote and uncertain as the first day of spring. Despite the slip of paper in my pocket entitling me to leave and warming my whole being like a glowing stove, I suddenly felt extremely lost in this huge, heavy country. Instinctively, I went to the main station building, where the Russian railwayman had seemed more profoundly sunk in inertia than any postal worker in France. I knew that it would be almost impossible for me to make myself understood because, even if one of them knew some German, I still spoke it so badly that my fellow soldiers were often hard put to it to make me out. I walked past the door several times, hoping that someone would see me through the pane of glass set in the heavy wood, and give me some information. As no one moved, I pressed my nose against the glass. Inside, I could see four railwaymen identifiable only by the filthy armbands they wore on their sleeves. Otherwise, they were just civilians, and seemed paralyzed by inertia. Not one so much as looked in my direction. I was astonished to see a gray-haired soldier sitting beside them, apparently infected by the same immobility. I looked again, to make sure I wasn't dreaming. But there it was, a soldier of the Reich fast asleep beside four citizens of occupied Russia. Outraged, I shoved violently against the door, and entered the room, where a heartwarming heat instantly inflamed my cheeks. I clicked my heels as loudly as I could, and the noise resounded like a gunshot through the calm heat of this remarkable place. The Russians started, and slowly stood up. My half-countryman and fellow soldier only shifted one of his legs. He looked about 50. "What can I do for you, comrade?" he asked, like a shopkeeper greeting a potential customer. I stood there for a moment, astounded by such casualness. "Well," I said finally, becoming more German than the Germans, "I'd like to know when the train to the fatherland will be coming through. I'm going home on leave." The other soldier smiled and slowly stood up. Then he walked toward me, bracing himself against the table, like a rheumatic. "So you're going home on leave, young fellow?" His voice sounded as though it might break into laughter at any movement, which irritated me. "A fine time to take a vacation. When will there be a train?" I was hoping to cut short the conversation I knew was coming. "You have a strange accent. Where are you from?" Unmasked again. I felt sure that I was blushing. "I have French relatives," I said, almost angry. "My father. In any case, I grew up in France. But I've been in the German army for nearly 2 years now." "Are you French?" "No. My mother is German. In cases of that kind, it's the father who counts, though. He was getting angry, too. "Look at that," he said to the Popoffs, who apparently hadn't understood a word. "They're even taking French kids now. What time will there be a train?"